I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's May 30th, and we have a lot to talk about. But first, we have some things to celebrate. This is the 300th episode of this podcast, and I remember 100 episodes ago when we celebrated episode number 200, I said that I couldn't quite wrap my head around that number. Needless to say, 100 episodes later, that's 100 times more true today. When we hit episode 200, I shared that those 200 episodes of Real Talk MS had been downloaded and listened to more than a million times. Today I can share that those 300 episodes of the podcast have been downloaded and listened to more than 2 million times. So thank you for placing Real Talk MS in the top 1% of the more than 5 million podcasts that are available today. Whatever success and longevity the podcast has had is because of all of you. It's truly an honor and privilege for me to be part of this weekly conversation with you. So I want to say thank you to each one of you in the Real Talk MS listener community for joining me for all the conversations we've had and all the conversations that are still ahead of us. And I also want to thank my partners at the National MS Society, especially Elizabeth Doherty, Elaine Lucero, Shannon Mastroani, Bruce Bebo, Barry Talenti, Ron Zwerin, Tim Cutsey, and Cindy Zagiboilo. Each of you makes it incredibly easy for me to do this. And while we're celebrating the 300th episode of the podcast, we're also celebrating World MS Day, a day that brings the global MS community together to share stories, raise awareness, and campaign with everyone affected by multiple sclerosis. I hope you'll find time to visit World MS Day on the web at worldmsday.org, where you can take advantage of their online poster maker and create your own personalized World MS Day poster. You can check out the online art exhibition, see the performance by the World MS Day choir, or find out about some of the other activities going on. Or you can visit World MS Day on Facebook at facebook.com/WorldMSDay, where you'll be able to connect with other people affected by MS who are living in countries all around the world. And I'll include both of those links in today's show notes. We have one more thing to celebrate today. This past weekend marked the conclusion of this year's Real Talk MS listener survey, and I just want to take a moment to say thank you to the several thousands of you who participated in the survey and to announce the winner of the $100 Amazon gift card. If you're wondering about the method used to select the winner, I used a list randomizer to scramble the order of all the names of the people who completed the survey and then looked at the very first name in that random order. And this year's winner is Brittany Miller. So congratulations, Brittany. I'll be reaching out to you today with your prize. And once again, a big thank you to everyone who participated. I want to remind you that this Friday, June 2nd, CanDo MS is hosting a day-long program specifically for people affected by MS. The program is called More About MS. And if you're in the Denver area, you can participate in More About MS in person. And if you're not in or around Denver, you can still participate virtually. You'll learn, practice, and come away with new wellness strategies. You'll hear from experts and get the latest information about coping with some of the most bothersome invisible symptoms of MS, like fatigue, pain, mood, and cognition. You'll find workshops on how to create and work with your healthcare team, how to navigate the DMT maze, staying active together, and how to thrive and survive as a support partner. The in-person program takes place Friday, June 2nd. It begins at 11 a.m. Mountain Time and goes to 4:30 in the afternoon, and that includes a free lunch and happy hour. And the virtual program will begin at 2 p.m. Eastern Time and go until 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And here's the best part. Both the in-person and virtual programs are absolutely free. So whether you plan on participating in person or virtually, you'll find a link for more information and to register for what promises to be a great program in today's show notes. The International Progressive MS Alliance is marking World MS Day by announcing a large-scale research program designed to implement solutions to some of the most challenging symptoms that people living with progressive MS have, specifically fatigue, impairment of mobility and upper limb function, pain, and cognitive impairment. Imagine just for a moment how different MS might feel if these particular symptoms could be mitigated or resolved. Now, the first stage of this new research pipeline has been completed, as the Alliance's request for applications has led to 53 applications from 11 countries, all being received prior to the May 15th deadline. Successful awardees will demonstrate a strong expert team that offers the potential for novel therapeutic interventions or outcomes for progressive MS. And in stage two of the pipeline, has the potential to culminate with a large randomized controlled study, and in stage three of this research pipeline, implementation for adoption into the larger healthcare system. This research pipeline was developed following a 2018 Progressive MS Alliance Global Scientific Congress that focused on symptom management and rehabilitation, as well as the publication of a paper in 2021 by an expert panel convened by the Alliance, outlining specific recommendations for advancing research in well-being. The paper noted that for many of the worst symptoms that might be experienced by individuals living with progressive forms of MS, there are insufficient treatment approaches that can provide relief and improve their quality of life. The paper also made clear that increased financial investment into studies of symptom management is needed if real progress is going to be achieved. Full transparency, I'm proud to say that I had the honor of being one of the co-authors of that paper, and to see the Alliance take the next step, literally by putting their money into this project that moves research and well-being for people living with progressive MS from a conversation into action, is more gratifying than I can even explain. If you'd like to review the details of the paper that was published in 2021, you'll find a link in today's show notes. We've learned that some members of minority communities experience a more severe MS disease course. But we don't know why, because historically, those minority communities have not been well represented in clinical research. But healthcare disparities aren't limited to research. They can also be seen in the quality of care for members of those communities. In last week's episode of the podcast, Dr. Bruce Bebo walked us through the latest research on the prevalence of MS in the United States, analyzing prevalence by race, ethnicity, sex, and geographic region. And the evidence serves as a clear reminder that anyone can get MS. However, not everyone with MS receives the same quality of care. My guest today is clinician researcher Dr. Liliana Amezcua, and we're discussing her work in exploring healthcare disparities among minority populations. In a moment, we'll meet Dr. Amezcua. Dr. Liliana Amezcua is a multiple sclerosis specialist and an associate professor of clinical neurology at the University of Southern California's Keck School of Medicine, where she's also the director of the Multiple Sclerosis Fellowship Program and the director of the Keck Huntington Beach Multiple Sclerosis Infusion Program. Dr. Amezcua serves as the principal investigator on multiple clinical projects, and her research interests include defining racial and ethnic disparities and discerning modifiable from non-modifiable genetic factors involved in MS severity and progression. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Amezcua.
Thank you for having me. Really excited to be here.
We often hear people talk about health disparities, and we also hear about inequities. But those two terms don't mean the exact same thing. Can you explain the difference between disparities and inequities?
Yes, absolutely. These are two terms that are commonly used interchangeably. And really, one is looking at disparities or differences between populations or people that are not necessarily being able to, for example, access the same resources. When we're talking about accessing resources or accessing medication or system-based necessities, we're talking about inequities. When we're talking about disparities is where we're actually seeing those differences impact, for example, how many people are getting the disease, how many people are affected with the disease, or we're seeing differences, for example, in mortality. Why are certain populations or group of people are dying faster compared to others? And even just that, not knowing even the cause, it tells you that there's a disparity in health, in those being unable to attain their best health for some reason and putting them at a disproportionate risk of getting more disability or reaching mortality much faster.
Tell me, what are social determinants of health?
Well, social determinants of health is really any type of social condition, meaning what we are born to, live, grow, die to, those factors that surround you and support you, and in many cases can, you know, end up actually being barriers to attaining. And here, and the person, you know, obviously concentrating on health, are preventing you to attaining the best possible health that you can. And these factors can be, for example, housing, education, the quality of the education that you are receiving, the neighborhood that you live in, the community support that you have, the governmental support, the policies in place. All of those are factors that basically can modify and affect the way that we live and the way that our health is developing or being affected.
Well, I think I'm going to touch on one of those social determinants of health with my next question. I've heard the term healthcare by zip code used to describe issues related to access to care and quality of care, but it can go further than that. Can you talk about how neighborhood conditions have an impact on disability accumulation in MS?
Yes. So lately, there's been a lot of focus on what we call social deprivation indices or some aspect of a zip code. And here in the United States, particularly, neighborhoods were not basically made at random. They were made, meaning they were structured in ways that put certain populations in certain places. Some of them were because of color. Some of them were because of income, right? And so these zip codes and where you live are basically tied, or they're a proxy, so meaning a representation of multiple variables or factors that make that zip code. So meaning, what's in that zip code? Is there a hospital, for example? How was that hospital made or supported? Was it made based on governmental funds because there's a lot of poverty around? Or was this a for-profit organization that settled here because there is possibility for profit because there's money? I mean, as simple as that. And so these zip codes can be very informative when you are wanting to understand perhaps some of the social determinants of health that are behind these discrepancies when you see people living in one zip code versus the other.
And this can actually extend to physical disability in MS. Getting that right?
That's right. That's right. And there is some data supporting that those with certain indices, right? So a much more deprived neighborhood using the zip code as a proxy are more likely to have higher disability levels. In some cases, it's associated also with being Black as background or lower socioeconomic status. Now, of course, we understand race is a social construct here. And so it's not because of the color of your skin, but because of the factors behind it that support that individual or not support them.
You know, that brings me to the very next question I was about to ask you. We know that research has provided evidence that members of historically underserved minority populations who are living with MS often experience a more severe disease course. Is there data available to be able to identify biological or genetic differences in Black and Hispanic populations that might explain this, or are we really looking at environmental factors?
Those are very important questions that still need to be answered. So we do see, like you said, first of all, let me just start off by saying that when we think about Black or African-American communities and or Hispanic and Latinx communities, they get MS, but historically, they've not been well represented in the MS research world, both in general research, but also in clinical trials. And so alone is a factor that may be playing in what we're seeing, right? So one of the things that we do see, like you mentioned, is developing disability at a faster rate or progressing. And in a lot of these studies still are missing pieces, right? Because we're just seeing it, comparing it to the communities that we've always known about MS, which is MS in white people. And so that is our reference. But when we understand that these communities may be at higher risk of other, for example, ill social determinants of health, then some of those factors may be playing a role. So, for example, we do see that Hispanic communities, or at least the studies that we've done, is that from the first symptom onset to diagnosis, there may be a three-year gap, which is much longer compared to when we look at individuals of white background getting diagnosed. So it's a much faster diagnosis for them. So that gap between the first symptom and diagnosis, if it's that long, of course, you have a higher chance of getting more disability. So one is diagnostic delays. But certainly in other studies, for example, in Black African-American populations, is that sometimes they don't see the delay, that there's also, they're worse, despite them perhaps being the same, diagnostic lag time. And so it starts questioning, is there a biological issue, right? But there's so many social, environmental factors that still could be playing a role that those need to, I think, be much more explored because they have higher capacity of being modified. A lot of, from the social determinants of health is that we understand that a lot of the variants, so the variants and outcomes in any condition can be explained by these factors up to 60 to 80%, depending on what studies you see. So that may leave maybe about 20% to biological inherent things that are harder to modify. But nevertheless, they deserve to be explored. So for example, in some of our studies that we've also done by looking at, even as simple as, what is the risk of known risk variants in MS? So in these populations, are they as relevant? Do you see all the same, 200 plus risk variants? What we have shown in both African-American and Black and Hispanic populations is that, yes, you do find a lot of the same risk variants, but they don't 100% replicate. So that tells us that perhaps there's some variants that could be not yet discoverable. And so they require their own studies, right? That we may be missing, right? But it also tells us that there's a lot more similarity between them. And so those need to be done. Now, you know, we've also looked at within cases. So within just being Hispanic, for example, and Hispanic or African-American, when we think about ancestry, right? So that is sort of your genetic global ancestry to past populations globally, which is not entirely all genetic, right? Because it's also components of environmental, where, you know, people settled and migrated, right? And so you do see that, for example, in Hispanics that have higher proportions of ancestry related to Native American, indigenous, you see that those with higher proportions are at higher risk of developing optic neuritis as their first symptom, twice more likely. When you look at age of onset, you also see that is not only those that have higher genetic ancestry of Native American, but also African. So independently, the African ancestry, both are can drive that presentation of MS at much younger. So meaning there are not only environmental, social factors that we need to look on, particularly for disease progression, and that's for anyone. I would also say it for any community of color or white. It doesn't matter the color. It's more of, can we modify? What are these social conditions? Can we do something about it? But biologically, we also need to better understand these populations, because one can argue and say, were they always affected with MS? Did we just miss them because every prevalent study was wrong in the past and it was all systemic racism? Or there's actually changes in the incidence over time in the world, right? And what are those epigenetic changes?
Well, to your point, I know you're leading a study that's focused on understanding the racial and ethnic differences that may contribute to Hispanic or Latinx and Black or African American individuals developing MS at a younger age compared to white individuals. Can you tell me about that work?
Yes. So like I mentioned, you know, we are interested in better understanding this sort of age of onset. And you know, we understand MS to start at a very particular age, right? Within this young adulthood, and there's a range, right? 20 to 40, and where do they mostly concentrate? And so for these two populations that when we compare them to white, and if there is this driver of behind that is related to genetic ancestry, the whole thought is, are these individuals that are developing MS at a much younger age, are they perhaps loaded with much more of those common genetic risk variants that we know? So meaning, do they have overall much more genetic risk factors than the environmental? So almost making a calculation, a weighted score of those risk factors is what we're very interested in understanding. And using admixed populations like African Americans and Hispanic people can help out with that. Because, and even African Americans, we understand is that they can be genetically admixed in some, you know, some can have 20% European background. And it's more of wanting to better understand, where do those genetic risk variants hold and lie? And if they're within either the European rich allele or that region and, you know, in the low gene, or are they within these, you know, non-European enrichment sites? Would we be able to sort out some of those genetic risk variants that are important to risk in the development of MS? And also, in the contrary, is to better understand those that develop MS at a later age. did they have less genetic risk factors and much higher environmental? Of course, this study won't answer that, but it'll provide a hypothesis for future studies.
Well, as you are able to collect your data, analyze it, and report back, I hope you'll come back to the podcast and share some of those results with us.
Absolutely. Anytime.
You know, earlier you mentioned the historic lack of diversity when it comes to clinical research, clinical trials. Today, we see efforts being made to try to ensure greater diversity in clinical trials. I'm wondering, what changes have you seen that make you optimistic that we're going to see greater representation of minority populations in clinical research?
Yes. So, well, first of all, I think now we are at not even just a national, but a global movement where diversity, equity, inclusion are really at the top. And we can talk about it more freely than before. I think the topics are now resonating with more people, right? The communities are more aware that they have been not represented. They're more aware that MS now affects them and that we're trying to do something about it. So I think it's not only the voices of us researchers, but it's also the voices of the people and people like you, right? Being able to communicate this to our community is so important. What I do see also is efforts from different stakeholders, right? So for example, the National MS Society, the Race to Erase MS, the MSAA, super, you know, important advocacy patient groups and foundations that are now dedicating some research efforts to better understanding these populations. From industry, we are seeing that they are wanting to be, you know, representing and be inclusive. And how do we recruit these patients? I think one important study that we did a couple of years ago, this was with the Accelerated Cure Project with but through the Minority Report, which is a PCORI-supported project. And it was to better understand sort of the perceptions of research. And it was sent out to about 2,000 patients. Out of those 2,000, there was about 200 African-American, Black patients, and then to about almost 200 Hispanic people of that background as well. And what you could see there is that overwhelmingly, all of them were very interested, irrespective of race or ethnicity. They all were interested in participating. You could see, you know, there was the altruism. Of course, there were perceptions and fears that were that resonate to historical events, right? That we need to also acknowledge, right? So, you know, the perception in these two communities that, you know, that they would either be taken advantage of or that their quality of care would be diminished by participating. And in some cases, there was also even concerns of their, you know, sort of immigration status. I mean, these were all important. They were not unique to MS, however. And so meaning to me, that tells us one is they are interested. Some of them are not being asked. We need to acknowledge their fears. We need to educate. And because of that study, for example, the MSAA reached out to me and Mitzi Williams to do these myth-busting series of talks that we did across that year. And we went around and just talking about what is research? What is clinical research? What is the level of involvement from observational to phase three clinical trials? What is the difference? Who's willing to participate? And I think I want to say that somehow I think that has been helpful. From the other perspectives was that, for example, Genentech, we were very interested in understanding ocrelizumab in these populations. We, you know, we all knew, and they recognized that there was very low participation or representation of these populations in their pivotal trials of ocrelizumab. And you know, we formed a team from the very beginning. So even of the thought of doing a study in them, from there to now, which I'll go over, to basically make sure and tackle the, you know, whatever the barriers within, from recruitment to retention. And very different to any study that I've ever participated is that even as we were talking about what the clinical trial should look like and the, you know, the protocol, the proposal, there was a patient involved, there was advocacy groups that were involved, and we wanted to make sure that the voices, you know, are heard of their needs. And we presented several aspects to the study. This is fully enrolled. It's in the middle of the, I think we just completed the 1 year follow-up. There'll be presentations regarding that. And certainly we're learning about, you know, how ocrelizumab, you know, works in these populations specifically. We're learning some of their basic characteristics at enrollment, which are slightly different. So they tend to be much younger in age. And so these are important things that will, I think, you know, is setting sort of the stage that we need to think moving forward about how we design clinical trials in the future to make sure that we are inclusive and enough diversity is present for us to say, hey, this works in everyone.
Well, Dr. Liliana Amezcua, thank you for all you do through your research and in the clinic to improve the lives of all people who are living with MS. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, John.
That's going to wrap up this 300th episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/300. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. I said this 100 episodes ago, and I can't think of a better way to say it. So let me thank you once again for your emails, your phone calls, your DMs, and your texts. Thank you for sharing the podcast with your friends and your family. And thank you for sharing this journey with me. Without each of you, I'd just be talking to myself. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.